from WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. And we start this week with a tour of some recent science headlines, compliments of our friends at Nature News. I'm joined now by senior physical sciences reporter Davide Castelvecchi. Nice to talk with you again.
Hi, Heather. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with this story making a lot of headlines. Google has published evidence that they have achieved quantum supremacy, which maybe just sounds like bragging and some egotistical term, but it's actually a technical term. Can you explain what quantum supremacy actually means?
Yeah, the idea is to have one of these quantum computers, this like technology of the future, show that it can actually beat a regular computer or even the best regular computers at any task.
And so they were able to actually do that, to get a quantum computer to do better than a traditional computer?
Yeah, so this machine in Santa Barbara, California, made by Google, performed a calculation in about 3.5 minutes. And they say that even the biggest supercomputer in the world would take 10,000 years, according to Google, to do the same calculation.
Wow, that's a big difference.
Now, there's caveats, of course. One is that it's not necessarily a very useful calculation, or at least not for the time being. And another caveat is that IBM, which manufactured the largest computer that we were talking about, says, well, no, actually, we could do that calculation. We're better than you thought. We could do it in just a few days. But still, the fact remains that 3 minutes is a lot faster than a few days.
You already mentioned, you know, the calculation they did was purely for the purpose of proving the power of this quantum computer, not necessarily any useful calculation. So how does this advance translate to being able to do more useful things with quantum computing? Are we actually significantly closer to that now?
It depends who you ask. There are a lot of researchers in the field who find this very exciting, and they say it's basically like the first flight demonstrated by the Wright brothers. You know, you just show that something can take off and land right away. It doesn't take any passengers anywhere, but it's still a milestone. And then there's others who say, yeah, but this machine still is plagued by a lot of issues that have been known for a long time, and it still will be decades before we have a quantum computer that actually is useful.
So another advance in a different field has gotten a lot of attention, and this is a tweak or a modification to the CRISPR gene editing system that the researchers say make it both less error-prone and effective in a wider array of cell types, so both more precise and more versatile. They say it could apply to more diseases now. So what's the change they made?
The change is quite radical, in fact, and it involves basically the way that DNA is cut up and replaced with a new sequence. The new technique uses an RNA single strand instead of DNA. An RNA is a little bit different than DNA, but it's a similar molecule. And basically, it coaxes the cell's own machinery into repairing itself and in a way that is less error-prone than the original CRISPR. So they call this CRISPR Prime.
Hmm. But there are some limitations to this, right? It's not necessarily going to replace the old CRISPR-Cas9 system completely.
At least not yet. One limitation is that RNA is intrinsically more fragile as a molecule than DNA. And so if you want to replace longer sequences of DNA in the cell, you would need a very long template of RNA, which is prone to breaking down. The cell itself tends to break down long RNA sequences quite fast.
So again, this is an advance in the lab. What are we talking about in terms of, you know, how long it might be before this new CRISPR Prime system might actually be useful in humans, if they're talking about this making gene editing workable for a broader array of diseases? Is that, you know, 6 months away or 5, 10, 15 years away?
I would guess that it's not 6 months away, because researchers tend to be very cautious about editing human DNA, especially when the edits can be passed on to future generations, as would be in a lot of cases, especially when you edit the DNA in embryos. And So this new version is supposed to be less error prone than the previous one, but still, you know, it takes a lot of there's a lot of steps involved in going from something that is basic research to the clinic.
So shifting gears, the Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo has been going on since August 2018, finally appears to be slowing down. I mean, this outbreak has not gotten the kind of media attention, at least, that the 2015 outbreak did. Can you just give us a sense of how big this outbreak has been?
It has been huge. It's been one of the biggest in history. And part of the problem with media attention could be that it happened this time in a war zone where it's extremely challenging for reporters to go. But all in all, more than 3,200 people have been infected and more than 2,100 have died.
And yet we've heard from World Health Organization and other experts that it could have been much, much worse if it weren't for the fact that responders have been using an experimental vaccine or vaccines, essentially, you know, testing these vaccines in this outbreak scenario, and they seem to be working. How important has that been, and where do those vaccines stand in terms of getting approval at this point?
How important it was is difficult to quantify at this stage, probably, but most specialists, most experts agree that the outbreak would have been much worse. And there's been almost 250,000 people who were given the vaccine. So it's difficult to guess how many of those would have been infected or would have died. But researchers are cautiously optimistic, and the European Medicines Agency has recommended that the vaccine be approved for broader use.
Potential good news going into future Ebola outbreaks, which brings us to another interesting story. Japan has imported Ebola and some other infectious diseases ahead of the 2020 Olympics. What is it they think they're preparing for?
There's a lot of preparedness in terms of all kinds of security when there's such a big event. Japan says that they want to be ready to have to experiment with faster ways of diagnosing if someone is infected, if someone is contagious. The bigger picture is that it's the first time that a lab in Japan is used for some of the most dangerous viruses, and it's kind of a crucial piece of research infrastructure for Japan to have to bring up this lab to this level of readiness.
Yeah. Well, so last but not least, the UK is planning to build the world's first fusion power plant. Now, of course, nuclear fusion is what powers the sun. Proponents have said for a long time this could be an infinite source of energy for the Earth. But as yet, it's never really borne fruit. Nobody's been able to get fusion going, creating more energy than it actually uses. So what do this group think they're going to do differently to actually get fusion to work?
Yes, the engineering challenges have been enormous, and the science challenges to even design a machine that is able to not just fuse atoms, but produce energy and even just as importantly, extract that energy and, you know, turn it into electricity. All those are things that require a lot of engineering, a lot of steps, and no machine has actually been designed yet to do all of those tasks. And this is what this machine would do. It's called the Spherical Tokamak for Energy Production, or STEP. And it's supposed to be up and running by the early 2040s, if all goes well. So far, it's not fully funded. The £200 million that have been announced are basically for the initial design, not even for starting construction.
So this is still in the very early stages. We'll have to watch that one for a couple of decades, apparently. That's Davide Castelvecchi. He's a senior physical sciences reporter with Nature. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. It's cold and flu season. That means flu shots, lots of hand washing, and maybe some extra vitamin C. It should also mean some cleaning house, according to my next guest. Seema Lakdawala is an assistant professor at the University of Pittsburgh, and she recently wrote about what we know about how flu is transmitted and how to prevent it for TheConversation.com. Seema, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So we know that flu spreads essentially three ways. There's direct physical contact with someone who's infected, right? Like touching their hands or their face or something like that and actually picking up the virus from them. You can also get it, of course, through the air, breathing in flu virus that's floating around in the air, or by touching surfaces like maybe door handles or something like that. But you say that we don't know the relative importance of these three different routes of being exposed to the flu virus. Would it even be possible to? I mean, it's not like you can go and do a genetic test on the flu virus that somebody's infected with and be like, oh, that came from the table, or that flu came from somebody's hand. How would we ever get a handle on this?
You know, that's an interesting question. There are lots of different strategies that people are employing to answer that question. You know, you can do epidemiological studies and say, can you limit household transmission by cleaning surfaces to get rid of, you know, contact transmission, things that you would get by touching surfaces. And then you could do human challenge studies to look at airborne transmission where people are not allowed to touch each other and really see if you can see transmission. We also obviously do that in animal models as a better way because it's hard to, you know, restrict human behavior. But you know, it's really interesting to think about how we can study this question. But sort of at a basic level, does it really matter, right? We know that if you get flu either by touching a surface and then getting infected by that, or if you breathe it in, you can still have a serious flu infection.
So what do we know about how long flu survives in the air and stays in the air?
Yeah, so some work that we did in my lab in collaboration with Lindsay Marr at Virginia Tech University, we aerosolized viruses in a rotating drum for up to an hour, and we've recently gone up to 2 hours, in the presence of human respiratory mucus. And what we found is that the virus doesn't lose any viability at any relative humidity condition that we tested for up to 2 hours.
Hmm. That's a pretty long time.
Yeah, exactly. You know, when you're in your office, people come in and out all the time. And if somebody had sneezed in your office, that virus is still viable, likely multiple hours after they've left. And then it can fall on surfaces and it can stay infectious in these surfaces as fomites for an even longer period of time. We've shown in some humidity conditions on plastic that the virus is stable out to 16 hours.
16 hours.
Yeah.
Wow.
And this is work that we had just recently published in M-Sphere, again, with Lindsay's team. And it's remarkable to think about what you've touched and who touched it maybe 24 hours before you.
I think about something like an ATM and how many people might touch an ATM in 16 hours. That's a lot of people.
Yes, it is. I mean, think about the elevator button. Think about a door handle for a bathroom. It can make you a germaphobe even if you aren't one.
I was about to say it could make you want to lock yourself in your own room for a few months. Well, yes. Seema Lakdawala, what do we know about better strategies for minimizing the spread of flu without each of us locking ourselves in an isolation chamber for 6 months of the year? And let's start with things like disinfecting wipes, because I will be the first one to admit that if one of my children gets sick, I become this compulsive, like walking around the house, just like everything they've touched, walking around behind them. I'm going to just wipe everything to hope that the whole family doesn't get sick. Does that actually work?
It will. So flu is quite wimpy. And even when it's protected in a mucus sort of environment, you know, wipes and things, you know, common household sprays will inactivate the virus. And really, it's about going and inactivating viruses on high touch surfaces, things that we're all touching all the time. I think that's definitely something that we undervalue when you're thinking about reducing transmission of viruses in our house. The other thing you can do is by helping people sneeze into their shirts, right? We release viruses. If someone is infected with flu, they're releasing the virus even just by talking or breathing. It's not only just by sneezing and coughing. And so it's important to think about ways to minimize just aerosol release in general into the environment. And so if you sneeze into your shirt as opposed to your elbow, really what you're doing is capturing those aerosols a little bit better. Wash your hands and try not to touch your face after you've touched something, and to be cognizant of that.
When it comes to things like washing your hands, or for that matter, you know, wiping up cleaning surfaces, are there best cleaners for this purpose? You said flu is kind of wimpy, but what does it actually take to have an effective cleaner?
You know, flu will inactivate even in 70% ethanol. So anything that's alcohol-based or bleach should inactivate the virus.
Like the hand purifier.
Yeah, yes. And hand purifiers are very effective at reducing flu because it's primarily alcohol. Yeah. And the other thing, going back to just besides cleaning surfaces, right, you can talk about how do you reduce the virus in the air. And one of the things when we're in our houses, you know, we don't think about enough. Hospitals and buildings have HVAC systems, but our homes and a lot of schools don't have that sort of sophisticated HVAC systems. And so the air isn't circulating very often. And I always tell people, I know it's cold in the wintertime, but think if you just open a window, turn on the fan, get the air moving, you're going to dilute out a lot of the virus particles so that when you're breathing them in, you're not breathing in, the load is reduced, right?
And is there any way beyond that to scrub the air, kind of clean the air and actually pull flu viruses out?
You know, there are a lot of air purifiers on the market that say they can do that. And we haven't, I don't know of any studies so far looking at that, but it's definitely an area that I think we're interested in as scientists to think about utilizing some of these technologies that are on the market to, you know, HEPA purify your airs that you can put in your house and turn them on when your kids are sick. The other thing is to humidify the air. And while we know that the virus itself isn't inactivated in aerosols at different humidity conditions, what we think happens is that as you increase the humidity, the droplets will take on water and then they'll fall out of the air, right? So these are viruses in these aerosols. Mm. And once they fall out of the air onto a surface, you can clean that. Then the likelihood of that transmitting to somebody else is a little bit lower because they have to touch that specific surface.
Given that flu can be deadly, obviously, there's good reason to take precautions. But where in your mind is that line between reasonable precautions and going a little overboard with the germaphobe thing? I mean, are we wiping our countertops three times a day, once a day, once a week? You know, kind of how proactive or active do we need to be in thinking about flu virus in our environments?
You know, that's a really good question. And I would say that we talked about at the very beginning about what is the relative contribution of each mode. And I failed to tell you that we do think that contact transmission is a little bit less efficient, right? Hmm. If you are in close proximity to somebody and you're not cleaning anything, then yes, you'll become infected. But if you imagine viruses falling out of the air onto a surface, somebody has to touch that surface and then they have to touch their face, as opposed to just breathing in air viruses from the air. And that immediately is going to go into your respiratory tract, which is the primary site of virus replication. Hmm. So, you know, I think it's really important to clean. Do we need to go around? I mean, after every child, I mean, I've got two little kids at home, and I couldn't even imagine the amount of time I would spend if I was following them around and cleaning everything they just touched. That would be my full-time job. I think that there is a line, and I think it's hard to say what that line should be for everyone because, again, we don't really know enough about the persistence of different viruses on different surface materials, right? You can also imagine that surface material deposition is going to matter. You know, did it fall on a copper dish? Well, then I wouldn't worry. I think the copper will inactivate the virus. Did it fall on a plastic toy? Then, yeah, maybe I might worry a little bit more. Hmm. Right. And so I think it's important to think about what is the material that the virus deposited on and how likely that is to, lead to a transmission event. Again, for me, and maybe it's because of my bias of working on airborne transmission for, you know, almost 10 years now, I really think that the contribution of aerosol transmission is one that we really need to consider during a flu season. And again, this is, you know, maybe increasing the humidity in your environment, turning on a fan if you can't open a window, and maybe trying out these sort of air purifiers.
And of course, getting a flu shot if you're eligible for that.
100%. And I don't want to actually ever minimize that. So our best line of defense is a flu vaccine. And we highly recommend that everybody get the flu vaccine, because while it may not protect you from getting infected, it can definitely limit the severity of your disease. And so when we're talking about life and death, you know, a lot of people do die each year from influenza. And so the vaccine is critically important to reduce those numbers. 100%.
That's Seema Lakdawala. She is an assistant professor at the University of Pittsburgh and recently wrote about how flu is transmitted and what we can do to limit that for theconversation.com. Seema, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Up next, pulling carbon out of the atmosphere. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. A carbon-neutral world by 2050. That's what climate scientists have repeatedly said is necessary to avert the worst impacts of climate change. That, of course, means dramatically reducing greenhouse gas emissions. But it's increasingly acknowledged that hitting goals like those set in the Paris Climate Accord will also require pulling emitted carbon back out of the atmosphere. In fact, such carbon capture technologies are a key part of many climate change scenarios. But are those technologies ready for, well, being deployed on the scale they would need to be to actually meet those demands? Gianna Amador is co-founder and managing director at Carbon 180, a nonprofit that champions carbon removal practices and technologies. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Introduce us to Carbon 180 a little bit, a nonprofit. You say the mission is to fundamentally rethink carbon. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so at Carbon 180, we think that carbon is really just in the wrong place. We're all here because we feel really passionately about solving the climate crisis. And while we know that we need to actively reduce emissions through solutions like renewable energy and electric vehicles, that we need to actively also remove carbon and clean that carbon and past emissions from the atmosphere. And so we really think that carbon isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's just in the wrong place. And in our atmosphere, it causes these impacts that are really detrimental to our society. But carbon is really all in the world around us. And we can actually capture that carbon and harness it in our soils, use it to power our industries and build our buildings and restore our forests. And so by harnessing that carbon, turning it from a liability in the climate to an asset to build our economy, we think we can solve the climate crisis quicker while also building a new world that was better than the one before.
And Carbon 180 is not actively developing those technologies in-house, right? It's about partnering with other people who are working on both the technologies and the policies that would lead to this kind of transformation that you're talking about?
Correct. We work at the intersection of business, research, and policy to help scale these solutions to what we need to in order to meet our 2050 climate goals.
So Gianna Amador, you kind of mentioned two parts to this equation, one of which is capturing carbon out of the atmosphere, and then there's putting that carbon to use not in the atmosphere. Let's start with that capture part. There are multiple ways to do this. The simplest of which is probably just planting trees. But realistically, how much of the solution could we, you know, accomplish with just planting trees?
We think of solutions in two big categories. So one is natural solutions, and those solutions use photosynthesis to capture carbon directly from the atmosphere. And while trees are a really powerful solution, we are limited by the total available amount of land that we can plant trees on. We think to reach the scale of carbon removal that we need, we also need to pair those solutions with technological carbon capture.
So also in the natural solutions category is actually growing attention on soils. How does soil become part of a carbon removal or carbon capture strategy?
Yeah, soils are a really exciting opportunity and one that has received a lot of attention in the last couple of years. Through photosynthesis, plants capture carbon, and then they transfer that carbon into the soils where it's actually stored for long periods of time. So if we farm in more sustainable ways or plant perennial crops that disturb the soil less, we can actually store more carbon in the soils. And the exciting part about this is that soils that are rich with carbon are also really healthy soils. And so these are sort of win-win solutions where we're building healthier soils for farmers who then see these benefits in things like yield increases on farm, or they have increased resilience to some of the impacts of climate change like drought and floods.
Well, Gianna Amador, you said that you see these natural carbon capture strategies as only part of the solution. The other part is that we're going to need actual technological ways of pulling carbon out of the atmosphere. And it seems like, you know, essentially putting scrubbers on power plant, exhaust stacks is probably the most efficient way to do that, right? Put some sort of scrubber on a really direct source of carbon emissions. Where does that kind of technology stand? I mean, it's not something that we're seeing widely deployed yet.
Yeah, there's actually a whole suite of technological carbon capture solutions, including the one that you're mentioning, which is carbon capture on point sources like coal-fired electricity. But at Carbon 180, we really take a much broader approach to the engineered processes that can capture carbon. And so these solutions use chemical processes a lot of times to capture carbon directly from the atmosphere. And so one of the really promising technologies here is called direct air capture, and it can actually remove carbon from the ambient air and then release a pure stream of CO2 that can be either then stored underground or used in valuable products.
And when you say valuable products, what might those be?
At Carbon 180, we call this carbon tech. And so it's really the conversion of carbon into any other carbon-based material. And this is sort of what I was hinting at before, where a lot of our world is actually made up of carbon today. It's just carbon from the ground instead of carbon from the air. So we can make plastics, fuels, chemicals, cements, carbon fiber. And these are just some of the examples of products that can be made from carbon that's captured from the air. And this is a really powerful opportunity. At Carbon 180, we did a market analysis to say what is the total available market size for products that are made from carbon. And we found that it was $1 trillion in the U.S. and over $5 trillion globally. So if we can harness the economic power and create businesses that actually profit from cleaning up our environment, that's a really powerful motivator to take action on climate.
You're using words like, if we can harness this, opportunities. I'm wondering, you know, in a really tangible sense, where do these technologies stand? I know of one case, the Boundary Dam Power Station in Canada, where they've put carbon capture technology on a large coal-fired power plant. That's been about 5 years, and a mix of successes and challenges there. I mean, how market ready are these carbon capture technologies?
There are a dozen small-scale direct air capture plants deployed across the U.S. today, and even more traditional carbon capture and storage projects on point sources. And the U.S. Department of Energy has, you know, spent 2 to 3 decades of research on traditional carbon capture and storage. But really, these direct air capture plants are starting to demonstrate this technology for the first time at commercial scale. And it's really important for us to work with businesses, investors, and policymakers to help provide, you know, financing support as well as first markets so that we can test these solutions in the real world and really understand their viability as an important tool in the climate solutions toolbox.
You mentioned a dozen direct air capture demonstrations or deployments, projects around the country. Can you just give us a sense of what that looks like, how it works? I mean, are we talking about some enormous fan in the middle of a field somewhere?
Yeah, one of the direct air capture facilities that I actually got to visit a couple years ago is based just outside of Zurich in Switzerland. And it's a really cool project to see in person. And you're right, it actually looks a little bit like a giant fan. So at this first, it's actually the first commercial scale direct air capture facility in the world. It looks like about 6 fans that are all sort of stacked on top of each other, and they use electricity to bring air through those fans. And inside the fan, there is a chemical solution that selectively binds with CO2. And then when it selectively binds with CO2, we're actually able to separate out the CO2 and basically put it into a giant bag. And then we can use that CO2 for valuable products or services. So in this case, they then pipe the CO2 to a greenhouse that's about 200 feet away and use that CO2 to grow cucumbers and tomatoes that you can have, you know, on your lunch in your salad.
It sounds almost like direct air capture, this idea of pulling carbon directly out of the atmosphere anywhere, out in a field, in your backyard, as opposed to right on top of a major source of carbon, is almost proceeding more quickly when it seems like the much larger challenge. What's going on there?
I think we've seen a lot of support, whether that's from the federal government or from businesses on traditional carbon capture. But I think the reality is that we have other solutions to decarbonize the electricity sector. Solar, wind, battery storage, these are all solutions that are fairly mature. And so I think the reason why direct air capture is getting a lot of attention is because it can help offset for sectors that are more difficult to decarbonize. And while we have solutions for the electricity sector, direct air capture can sort of make up for some of the areas where we're moving more slowly.
And for that matter, you used this phrase earlier, past emissions. There are those who hope that direct air capture, pulling carbon back out of the atmosphere, could actually be used to not just achieve net zero, but actually start reducing the total amount of carbon in the atmosphere and help essentially kind of take us back in time climate-wise.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what the science says we need to do. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the UN's highest climate science body, said that in order to meet our 2-degree goals, which is not even the most ambitious goal posed by climate activists or by climate scientists, but that in order to meet those 2-degree goals, over 87% of the scenarios that they map out require not only for us to get to net zero, but actually go to net negative emissions by 2100. So this is something that's widely underscoring are the climate pathways that we're trying to follow, but really hasn't received enough attention to date.
Gianna Amador, as someone who champions carbon capture technology development and deployment, working at this intersection of the science, of the policy, where do you see the greatest challenge right now? Is it funding for technology development? Is it just that the technology is hard? Is it a policy matter? What's the sticking point at this point?
I think on the technology side, deployment is something that's really difficult. The companies and startups who are developing these solutions face a number of what are called like valleys of death. So really difficult areas in which they don't have the financing to sort of get the next stage of funding in order to move their solutions from lab to market. And I really think that that sort of gap right now is around deployment. And so that's why we work with scientists, businesses, and policymakers to help fill that gap. And that can be done either by providing first markets for some of the products that are made in this space, or the federal government can provide financing support through mechanisms like loan guarantees. And this is something that the federal government is very used to doing and has done over 3 decades for solar and wind. And so it's really about expanding the purview of the government's climate solution toolbox to really include carbon removal.
If you could write the federal budget, how much would be in there for carbon capture, carbon removal, and carbon storage? What's the economic scope of what we need to do here, you think?
So the National Academies of Sciences actually put out a research roadmap last year that really outlined the full scope of federal RDD&D. That's research, development, demonstration, and deployment that was needed to bring these solutions to scale. So they're really the experts on this. But I think to give you a sense of the scale of the challenge, we're looking to build an industry that's double the size of the current fossil fuel industry. Mm. And solutions like direct air capture have received a total cumulative funding of $11 million over the entire course of history. So we're looking to really increase that to the scale of hundreds of millions of dollars. And that's the type of serious investment that's needed to bring these solutions to scale. And again, that's a type of investment that we've seen for other climate solutions.
Gianna Amador is the co-founder and managing director at Carbon 180, a nonprofit that champions carbon removal practices and technologies. Gianna, thanks for talking with us.
Yeah, thank you again for having me.
Up next, how we make decisions in the face of uncertainty. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. You've heard the old Benjamin Franklin quote that nothing can be said to be certain except death or taxes. Well, my next guest says even those are uncertain, that uncertainty is the human condition. But we have multiple ways of managing uncertainty and making choices even in the face of unpredictable outcomes. Timothy Pleskotch is a professor of psychology at the University of Kansas and co-author of a new book, Taming Uncertainty. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Let's start with this idea that even death and taxes are not certain, as you make plain in the dedication of the book, making sure to get that out there early. I'll give you taxes, right? All it takes is a rule change to change your taxes. But uncertainty and death?
It's a little bit of a play on this that we were trying to think about just how uncertain even when death is going to happen. And depending on your beliefs, right, what happens after death? And maybe it's a little bit of a play on the words, but we were trying to just convey that uncertainty is just this human condition that we're always around, and we always overestimate how much certainty we have. But really, it's a large world of uncertainty that we're navigating and steering inside of.
It also highlights, though, a point that you make in the book, which is that there are different types of uncertainty and different sources of uncertainty. Give us some of the kind of broad categories, how you think about types of uncertainty.
Yeah, there's all sorts of different types of uncertainty. One is strategic uncertainty, right? The type of uncertainty when you're interacting with other people and how they're going to act. Another type is environmental uncertainty, just the pure uncertainty about how events are going to happen in the world, from the weather to earthquakes, that type of uncertainty. Another type of uncertainty is epistemic uncertainty. Your lack of knowledge about a particular domain, right? So a good example is which city is further north, New York or Rome, right? And so everyone kind of like thinks, well, New York is, but actually Rome is.
I mean, right? That's an interesting one, because in that case, at a factual level, there is no uncertainty. You know, it is possible to know exactly which one is farther north, but that's just, as you said, our own lack of knowledge or confidence in our knowledge.
Yeah, and that illustrates that, you know, there's a kind of a duality possibly about uncertainty. And that's one of the ideas of uncertainty that's been popular in philosophy, of a duality. Kind of there's this uncertainty about our own knowledge, but also uncertainty in terms of what events are going to happen, and that's outside of the world. And one of the things we try to take on in the book is we try to put forward an idea that maybe it's not so much you got to think about a duality aspect, but like a systemic idea of uncertainty, that we have to both understand how the environment, the structure of the environment, and also the mind works in order to understand how the mind handles uncertainty and how people handle uncertainty.
Do you think the world has gotten more uncertain, or have we gotten more attuned to it, more concerned about uncertainty?
You know, my initial reaction is I don't know if the world has gotten more uncertain, right? But I think we've become more attuned to it. An example I give in my class is that, you know, up until the late 60s, and I wasn't around at that time, but weather forecasters was convention just to give kind of a deterministic forecast, right? It's going to rain or it's not going to rain. And then they started to use probability to convey the likelihood of a chance of rain. And so I usually invite my students to kind of think about that. How weird would it be to actually tune into a weather forecast now where you don't get a communication of the uncertainty around it? And so I my opinion is that really we're just more in tune to it, and maybe better understanding that things are, there's stochasticity or noise in how things are happening. And we also take the perspective that we're quite effective in handling this, right? We've made it this far. Yeah, there are some times we make mistakes, but a lot of the rules and heuristics or strategies that we have been quite effective. And so we should understand in what cases they're effective. And that's something we're trying to handle in the book.
Well, Timothy Pleskotch, let's talk about that, because that is the main focus of the book, Taming Uncertainty, those tools that we have at our disposal. And I want to talk about one that you don't fully dismiss, but kind of say you want to get past. It's one that we've focused a lot of attention on, and you've already mentioned it. And it's this idea of probabilities. And you kind of say, well, you know, we've maybe focused on that too much, that this is how we handle uncertainty, is we come up with probabilities and we base our decision on probabilities. What do you think the problem is with that argument, or why do you think that's been given too much weight and too much focus?
So let me give you an example. There's a kind of a conventional example that's given in the textbooks to kind of introduce this idea, where the person is invited to like imagine that they're with their partner making an omelet, right? And the partner steps out of the room and you agree to take over making that omelet. And, you know, the partner has already put 4 or 5 eggs in the bowl and started to work with it. And then there's one egg left to the side, right? And the question is, what do you do with that egg, right? Is it a good egg or is it a bad egg? How do you make that decision, okay? And the idea with kind of that philosophers, economists, mathematicians, and statisticians have taken is that, well, the way I handle that is I think, okay, what's the probability that this is a good egg and what's the probability that that's a bad egg? So that number kind of quantifies your belief. Now, that could be the case, but it seems to us that that doesn't actually maybe capture how people come to that probability.
I'm definitely listening to this thinking, I definitely wouldn't be going for probabilities, at least not good egg, bad egg, maybe kind of roughly getting at probabilities, trying to figure out more what was my partner thinking before they left the room, rather than trying to look at the outside of an egg and figure out with no information if it's good or bad.
And so that's where you might have different tools or strategies you could use. So like a heuristic you might use is to kind of infer the probability.
So what is a heuristic?
So one, a heuristic is a mental shortcut that doesn't always give us the right answer, but often gives us a good answer. And that would be a rule of thumb. So one of the ones we talk about in the book is a risk-reward heuristic. So you can infer the likelihood of an event from the size of the payoff. So imagine, you know, somehow you get into a conversation with your partner and she or he knows this and says, I bet you some amount of money, right? You can infer kind of what that probability is. And we talk about where you could use that heuristic in other places to infer the likelihood of an event. But that might not be the only way, right? There could be other strategies you use. You could essentially ask your partner, you could ask a friend, right? And that's kind of one of the ways we talk about in the book, that you could consult your social world to kind of figure out, is this a good egg or a bad egg? And that is a little bit different than kind of forming your own belief. The other one is you could search and explore. You know, maybe you could open the refrigerator. You could kind of try to figure out what's going on. And that's another strategy that we talk about in the book of how do people kind of explore and search and gather information about that egg.
You point out in the book that we have all of these different tools, but then you highlight the fact that, of course, the same tool might not be the right tool for every decision. And you've got to find the right fit between the uncertainty and the tool you use to cope with it, which raises this whole other level of uncertainty, which is, how do I choose which tool to use?
Yeah, this is actually one of the problems that has really gotten our group going of thinking about this. We think of the mind as kind of a toolbox, but even like kind of a mechanic that has a bunch of tools that all kind of fit the right job, right? And a good mechanic kind of knows what tool to go, but there's still there's uncertainty about how do you select the right tool for the right job. And that's a difficult problem to kind of figure out how the mind does that. And also, you know, how can we kind of understand that psychologically?
And of course, you point out that both the tools we have at our disposal and the choices we make about which tools to use change over the course of our lifetime. And it's tempting or maybe reassuring to think that we just get better. Yep. We have more tools and we choose the right tools more frequently as we get older and more experienced. Is that actually what we see?
This is one of the great insights we had while we were writing the book, where in our group, we have a lot of different people, and some of the people are developmental psychologists, and they really pushed us to think about, you know, when we talk about uncertainty, we're just talking about it in a fixed place, but really across the lifespan, it's changing both how our mind is functioning and how we handle that uncertainty. at some level, we could say that in some cases, how we handle uncertainty, even the tools change, right? So there could be even adaptive aspects of forgetting, right? Sometimes we forget stuff, but that can actually turn out to help us make better decisions because we might forget the stuff that we should kind of lose, right? And there can be an adaptive aspect. At the same time, as you acquire more information, more tools, then you have this problem of kind of selecting the right tools. And that was a really fascinating aspect that, to be honest, I think our field and our area really has to start to think about. For a very long time, we've thought as if our preference for risk is not changing. But in fact, it changes across the lifespan. And we talk about this in the book, that generally people become a little bit more risk-averse if we really look at it.
Timothy Pleskotch, Taming Uncertainty, that title for the book. I mean, we've talked about tools for coping with, adapting to, managing, trying to constrain, I guess. But taming uncertainty, is that possible?
This is you're giving us insight into the conversations we had as we were thinking about a title for this book. In fact, my student was telling me that he really thought we should be actually talking about embracing uncertainty. Because really we're talking about a very positive aspect that really the world is uncertain and we've learned how to kind of work with it. But taming uncertainty we came to as kind of a way that, you know, we really deal with it. And we want to put out the argument that the mind has been quite successful and has a nice repertoire of tools to handle that. But we haven't done a very good job of studying how the mind handles that uncertainty.
And why is it important to study it? I mean, we all have this very inherent visceral understanding that there is uncertainty in our lives, in the world, and that we are finding ways to handle it. Why is it important to label that and study it and understand it in this more academic way?
Oh, that's a good question. I'll give you two examples. One of them is a famous study that's out there by the psychologist Walter Mischel, which many people are kind of familiar with now, where a long time ago he gave children a choice between one marshmallow and two marshmallows. And the key was they could eat the one marshmallow right away, or they could, if they waited for the experimenter to come back, then they could eat the second marshmallow.
This sounds like a great way to torture young children.
Yeah, it actually had a lot of attention as of recently, because it looks like some of those children that are willing to wait for that second marshmallow look more successful in life, right? But if you go back and you look at how the study was run, the way they communicated to the children was that they actually said, well, it'll take a little while before the experimenter will come back. So in fact, they didn't really tell the child how long they would have to wait for that experimenter to come back.
Right. They introduced uncertainty as well as a wait.
Yeah, there's uncertainty rather than, it's just not simply time or patience, right? There's some uncertainty. And these researchers at the University of Pennsylvania, they really did a lot of the legwork here. They showed that, look, when you look at, and you if you think about the different types of expectations about when that the researcher will come back, that could change how patient you are. The example I give is, think about a text message or an email, right? If you send off a text message and it doesn't get replied to right away, it's probably going to take a very long time. You might as well move on or act on whatever you're going to do. Same thing with email, right? So if the child is thinking, if the experimenter is kind of, the way they come back is kind of like an email, right? And it hasn't come back right away, then they might as well go ahead and eat that one marshmallow, right?
Right.
It makes quite good sense. And this isn't my example of why uncertainty can be a very important idea that we have to embrace, because it changes how we interpret behavior.
And that understanding or misunderstanding of the role that uncertainty played in those children's decisions has affected a generation of parenting advice as well.
Yeah. So once we start to think about that, then you can start to think about, what's different here? Now, there's probably a component of patience playing in there, right? So we don't want to overblow it, but we do want to say that could be a very important aspect to understand and give context to how these children are thinking, but just understand even the what's called intertemporal choices, how we trade off time in our decisions.
Timothy Pleskotch is a professor of psychology at the University of Kansas and co-author of Taming Uncertainty. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Until next week, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.